Welcome, everybody. Welcome to TwerpCast.
Welcome back, true believers. Timewell Electronic Recording Productions presents HeroCast, TwerpCast Episode 2. TwerpCast is a secret government project designed to dull the senses. You must have clearance level of Olive Baseball or above to hear this. If you are listening on YouTube or iTunes, turn it off now. You are in violation of FEMA regulations. Turn yourself into the nearest Homeland Security office. For those of you with the proper clearance, we now present HeroCast, a retrospective of superhero movies and their effect on the masses and their dulled senses. I'd like to introduce James Caswell, executive producer in charge of Diet Coke belches and armpit farts, not to be confused with that other drug-addled gas bag, Rush Limbaugh.
And I'd like to introduce my friend and cohort, Doug Zeitlin, executive producer of oddball ideas that even Al Gore wouldn't take credit for. Today's HeroCast is going to actually have a few parameters on it. For this particular episode, we're going to focus on live-action films based on comic book characters. Likewise, we're going to focus on movies and not television shows or TV movies, which we'll address at a later date. That'll be HeroCast Part 2. So I thought we would start out with what comic books are.
Ultimately, comic books did start out as magazines. They were meant as a form of advertisement. There's a story, and in every other page, there's an ad to buy something. They told detective stories and had 26 issues before Batman ever appeared. They had Western stories, outer space stories, horror comics. Tales from the Crypt started out as a comic book.
And let's not forget action comics.
Things like All-Star Comics. Not Justice Society, they were All-Star Comics. At some point around 1938, you had Superman, you had Batman, and these characters started to take the hearts and minds of the children. Just prior to the introduction of Superman and Batman, we have Flash Gordon appearing in the Daily Comic Strips. Flash Gordon makes his big screen appearance in 1936.
The popularity of Flash Gordon, both in the comic strips and in the movie serials, contributed a great deal to the comic book industry transforming itself from telling graphic fiction to telling stories about superheroes. Let's keep in mind that in the late 1930s, the United States was going through what would later become known as the Great Depression. People needed somebody to look up to. People needed hope.
So yes, they're looking for hope, and they're finding some external outlets for this. They're finding their escapism. They're finding it in dime novels, in the comic strips, and translating it into the movies. Serials are bringing a small piece of hope to people every single week. For those who don't recall what a serial is, serial is a movie told in short segments over a period of many weeks. Once a week, you see a little adventure of Flash Gordon in the newspaper. Once a week, you see a little adventure of Flash Gordon in the movie screen.
It was a great way to bring audiences back week after week because you'd have a Flash Gordon serial, you'd have a few cartoons, and you'd have your
main feature and your second feature, not like movies today.
All for the low, low price of about a dime.
To wrap up the 1930s and 1940s, you have Superman comics coming out, you have Batman comics coming out, you have Superman serials coming out, you have Batman serials coming out.
During this time period, what would later become DC Comics pretty much monopolized this particular industry. While Captain Marvel wasn't a DC comic at the time, you had Captain Marvel, you had Spy Smasher, you had Batman, you had Hop Harrigan, you had Vigilante, Superman, Congo Bill, Batman and Robin, Atom Man vs. Superman, and Blackhawk, Fearless Champion of Freedom. Whereas what would later become Marvel Comics had one serial feature throughout all that time, and that was, of course, Captain America. Very popular at the time because it was in the middle of World War II, and people wanted a patriotic character to get behind.
So how do you rate these? It's hard to say with today's sensibilities.
It's very hard to say with today's sensibilities.
These things are made on a shoestring budget. The acting is horrendous. The episodes are probably being filmed in the same 15-minute time frame they're being shown.
5, 6, 8, 10 takes? No. You got it in one take and moved on. And for those who think, oh, they're ignoring the independents, no. Flash Gordon was considered an independent at the time, and he actually had three serials, Flash Gordon, Flash Gordon's Trip to Mars, and Flash Gordon Conquers the Universe, plus Buck Rogers and the Phantom. They were very popular for their time, but by the mid-1950s, serials were starting to go by the wayside. They were doing higher budget films, and you weren't getting multiple films in one sitting anymore.
It's not until the 60s you see the reintroduction of the superhero into the movie scene.
And even at that, there were only really two movies, and they were filmed camp style. And that was Batman the Movie and Spy Smasher Returns.
and Batman the movie, I think you could argue, although it is based on a comic character, that Batman movie was from the television series. It was a, let's make some money off this popular TV show.
I remember seeing an interview with Burt Ward where he thought he was going to have the summer off, and they said, no, this is making us too much money, you're making a movie. So with only two movies in the 1960s, I really don't feel right in spending a whole lot of time here, especially for such campy films. Now, that's not to say that camp is bad. Camp is actually quite enjoyable as long as you know it's camp.
And there was the problem with Mystery Men. Mystery Men was a very campy superhero story, and it was spectacular. Had it been pitched as a comedy superhero story, I think people would have gone to see it and enjoyed it.
Moving on to the 1970s and 80s.
We had wonderful films like Howard the Duck and The Punisher.
The Punisher, which was never released in theaters. What really kicked all of this off was the Man of Steel himself. Who over the age of 30 doesn't remember?
You will believe a man can fly. I think ultimately it comes down to the most important person who believed a man could fly was Richard Donner.
And he did a wonderful job. I didn't care if you could actually see any strings or not. To my 8-year-old eyes, Superman flew. Not Christopher Reeve, Superman. From the top down, it was just the most superb movie for its time, and I'm even hesitant to put that qualifier in there.
The Superman movie withstands the test of time. Yes, the vehicles are dated, the hairstyles are dated, but it's the story. That overgrown Boy Scout has been an American favorite since the 1930s when he came out.
While we're on the subject of Superman, and I realize that I'm jumping ahead on the time frame some, but I want to spend a moment just talking about Christopher Reeve. Like I said, to my 8-year-old eyes, he was Superman, Superman flew, Superman was a hero. But a decade and a half later, when he was at his weakest, that's when Christopher Reeve, the man, became a hero.
I think that Dana and Christopher Reeve truly are heroes of our generation.
That being said, we'd like to encourage everyone to go visit the Christopher Reeve Foundation website at www.christopherreeve.org, and if at all possible, go on ahead and make a donation. It's for a worthy cause. Now, before we get way too misty-eyed to read our notes, I think it's time to move on.
Sure, let's talk about Superman 2.
Which one? The one that came out in 1980 or the good one?
All right, let's talk about both. I think the Lester version was an adequate sequel. It was an action movie. The point that he kind of missed was it wasn't really like a sequel. Superman 1 and 2 were meant to be one big movie with just a break in the middle. Like Pirates of the Caribbean 2 and 3, they were filmed back to back, and it was really one story.
Now, I will say this much. In 1980, I thought it was a very good sequel. It wasn't until 2006 that I realized that it wasn't as good of a sequel as I thought it was.
I'll agree with that. To my 10-year-old eyes, Superman 2 was a perfect movie, and I really enjoyed that, and I wanted to see it over and over again when I had my original recording in Betamax. And again, to their credit, Superman of the 1930s was meant for a children's audience. If you were targeting this movie at a children's audience, you did a very good job.
But if you were targeting to a children and adult audience who saw the first movie, it didn't quite hit the mark.
I don't know if they recognize a mistake or just looking out for a buck.
My vote is for the buck.
That's my vote. I would love to give them the benefit of the doubt. I'm too cynical.
I'll tell you what, I'll meet you halfway. I'll just give them the doubt.
All right. They let Richard Donner go back in there and re-edit the movie the way he wanted it, and about 80% of that movie is all his. There's only a very small percentage of the Lester footage left.
And that was because he got stopped before he got the chance to film everything that he wanted to film.
I think he did something really brave here also. For the 1980 movie, Richard Donner had shot a screen test between Christopher Reeve and Margot Kidder. This was the original revelation that I am Superman. This scene was never actually filmed for use in the movie. In the new DVD version, they have put that scene as the reveal, removing the Lester footage.
Now, keep in mind that this footage was what got Christopher Reeve and Margot Kidder their roles.
When you see it on the DVD, it's somewhat out of place. Christopher Reeve has a different hairstyle. He's wearing a different pair of glasses. But it's not important. It's the story that's important. And the story is told so well in that scene that it's used, and it's used well on the DVD.
So we have the Richard Lester version, which we thoroughly enjoyed. It was very good. Our young eyes and our young hearts still have very fond memories of his version. our grown-up eyes and our grown-up hearts kind of lean more towards the Richard Donner version.
Honestly, I was shocked when I watched the Richard Lester version when it was first released on DVD. Because I remember as a child loving this movie. I remember watching it on television, absolutely loving this movie. And then I watched it on DVD as an adult. It nearly put me to sleep.
And that's not even making reference to things like the expanding shield that acts as an entanglement.
Richard Lester did invent several superpowers.
But as creative as Richard Lester got, he didn't do nearly as much damage as Superman 3. Of course, some people could say that Superman 3 didn't do nearly as much damage as Superman: A Quest for Peace.
What can we really say about Superman 3 and 4? For those who don't know this, Richard Pryor was a huge Superman fan. Richard Pryor was also a huge vehicle for the Warner Brothers studio, as was Superman. Somebody in the studio thought it would be great to take these two huge properties and you put them together. You have your comedian and your superhero movie, and you make the funny superhero movie. This would work had everyone been on the same page. Richard Pryor wanted to do a straight superhero movie. The writers and producer wanted to do a comedy. Ultimately, what they got was a piece of garbage. I love Richard Pryor. Stir Crazy, 48 Hours, even some of the bad movies with him and Gene Wilder in them, I think they're a hell of a lot better than Superman 3.
But again, as bad as Superman 3 was, it looks like it was filmed on gold in comparison to Superman 4.
I would love to say that Superman 4 has redeemable values. I don't mind a political agenda in a movie. There have been many movies, many television shows, many plays that have a political agenda. Arthur Miller's The Crucible, a play which was not about the witch trials, it was about the McCarthy trials. I don't mind, and I in fact encourage people to put forth their own political agendas, be they left-wing or right-wing, does not matter. I understand people have these agendas. This was a bad movie. It's Superman 4. If you agree with this movie's politics, you still hate this movie. This is a bad movie. So I'll take a step back, because we've got these four Superman movies that come out. In the middle, there's another lesser-known superhero movie, The Swamp Thing. Lower budget, not advertised as much, it's out there. If you have read the Swamp Thing comic book, this is a really good interpretation of the Swamp Thing comic book. They've kept very true to the characters, it is well written, it's well directed and well acted.
But not well received.
Well, Swamp Thing is one of those peripheral characters. He can definitely be described as an anti-hero.
Swamp Thing is a perfect example of what happens when you take a C-list character and try to make a movie based on him.
Keep this in mind when we talk about the future C-list movies coming out. But as poorly received as Swamp Thing was, it still generated a sequel. They decided to take this movie, which had done so well at adhering to the comic book, and said, hey, if we make it camp and put Heather Locklear in it, it's going to be a success.
And if we put Heather Locklear in a wet t-shirt, it will be an even bigger success.
So, for this time period, I would give Superman 4 pens in the pocket protector, Superman 2, the Richard Donner edition, 4 pens in the pocket protector. I would not put Superman 3 or 4 in the pocket protector.
Those go directly into the trash.
Swamp Thing, I would give 3 pens in the pocket protector. Return of the Swamp Thing gets to go with Superman 3 and 4.
But that is not the end of the DC films for the 70s and 80s. We left off, perhaps on purpose, the fifth Superman movie. A little film that came out in 1984 called Supergirl.
TV side note, she will be added to the cast of Smallville next year.
The producers of the original Superman movies saw the popularity of the franchise and said, hey, there's this other character. Let's do a story based on her. And initially, all of the characters from Superman were supposed to at least make a cameo to fully tie it into the canon of the 70s movies. As it was, only Jimmy Olsen and Lois Lane's little sister Lucy made appearances. Christopher Reeve obviously showed good taste.
Considering he did Superman 3 and 4, that surprises me.
To be honest, Supergirl wasn't that bad. Problem is that it wasn't that good.
I think that Supergirl was an average, mediocre movie. It had Helen Slater in it. It had Peter O'Toole in it. Yeah, I guess that's the best you can say about that movie, isn't it?
It was a decent story. The problem is that a lot of people went to go see it and were expecting a Superman 1 or Superman 2 quality movie and got something a little bit better than Superman 3.
I think we need to make one quick reference, going back to the independent comics and the independent movies, the 1980 Flash Gordon movie.
Flash!
Savior of the universe!
Okay, now that we've driven off all of our listeners...
For people who have actually seen the original Flash Gordon serial, so had the director of the Flash Gordon movie. if you were to take pictures of the actors who played, say, Ming the Merciless and Voltan from the serials and compare them with pictures of Ming and Voltan from the 1980s movie, it's like they were casting based on appearances alone.
And I think they were.
Okay, yes. The script was the standard Flash Gordon material. Ming's trying to destroy Earth. Flash Gordon goes to try and save Earth. Wasn't a lot more to it.
Flash Gordon had such name actors as Sam Jones and Timothy Dalton in the lead roles. I think that kind of explains everything right there.
It does explain a lot. However, the producers, in their wisdom, decided to get a grade A band to do the soundtrack. And I think that the Queen soundtrack to Flash still holds up again today, 27 years later.
Again, 10 years old. I thought it was great. All the color, all the flashing lights, all the quote-unquote cool special effects, because back in 1980, that was state-of-the-art, top-of-the-line special effects, even though we look at it now and go...
As an 11-year-old in 1980, I thought this was a spectacular movie. This was a fine follow-up to Superman 2. I mean, what a great summer this must have been. Superman 2 and Flash Gordon in the same summer. I look at it now, and I'm of two minds of it. I love B-movies. If the intent of this movie were to make a B-grade movie, I would find it entirely successful. This is a great movie. If the intent was to make a blockbuster in the vein of Lord of the Rings, it bombed. You got that right. Personally, I can watch this movie over and over again. I am a B-movie fan.
And I thoroughly enjoy sitting down about once every 3 years and watching it myself.
And so, before we left the 1980s, Tim Burton will leave us with something that is either famous or infamous, depending on how you look at it, the 1989 Michael Keaton Batman movie.
Who at the time could look at Michael Keaton and go, yeah, that's Batman?
It's hard to go back to that time, because people now know him as Batman. But if you were looking at him and you saw Mr. Mom or the guy from Night Shift...
Definitely the guy from Night Shift.
The assumption would be to replace Adam West in doing a campy Batman movie.
But Tim Burton wanted to make a serious Batman film, and nobody could believe it.
Well, Michael Keaton did have Clean and Sober under his belt.
That was actually the part that sold him as being Bruce Wayne.
And the only reason I went to go see the first Batman movie.
I couldn't believe how great of a job he did.
I remember the fan outcry. I was regularly reading the Batman comic books. I read the letters pages. Serious fans did not want Michael Keaton as Batman.
They just couldn't picture it. And I'll admit, I was right there with them. I looked at Michael Keaton, and I saw the Night Shift guy. I loved that movie. I mean, it was hilarious. But you don't look at Batman and go, he's so funny!
You're right. A normal person does not look at Batman and go, he's so funny. I don't know what Joel Schumacher's excuse is. Burton does Batman, Batman Returns. I would call them 4 pens in the pocket protector and 3 pens in the pocket protector, respectively. And then Joel Schumacher comes over. So he directs these movies, Batman Forever and then Batman and Robin.
Batman and Batman Returns had a dark edge to them, which worked great for Batman.
He is the Dark Knight. George Clooney has taken a lot of blame for killing Batman single-handedly, and that could not be further from the truth.
He does not deserve that.
The problem was the way the script was written.
The way the script was written, the way the script was directed. I've seen almost every Arnold Schwarzenegger film out there, and I've never seen him act that bad.
This is by far the worst Schwarzenegger movie,
I mean,
ever.
I've seen Hercules, and he was better in that than in Batman and Robin.
For those of you who want to see a really, really bad Schwarzenegger movie, rent a movie called The Villain. It's an incredibly bad Roadrunner, Wile E. Coyote ripoff movie, and it is 100 times better than Batman and Robin. George Clooney, you are completely forgiven in this matter. You are not culpable for anything.
You can only work with the material that's given you.
Joel Schumacher, you deserve time in prison for those movies.
Yes, you directed Lost Boys. You directed Phantom of the Opera.
I wish he had just stopped at Lost Boys. In Phantom of the Opera, the main protagonist is a pedophile murderer. Somebody that I can really get behind. Not.
In fact, you really don't want him getting behind you.
Ba-dum-bum. Here we are in the 90s with the Batman movies, all of them incredibly successful, despite some of them being incredibly horrible. And we have these other comic strips, comic books, made into movies.
You mentioned really, really horrible. You can't let that statement go without mentioning the other 1990 DC film.
It stars Shaquille O'Neal. Do you need to say anything else about it? For those who don't know what we're talking about, God has blessed you. The name of the movie was Steel.
I will say that we do know someone who actually worked on that film.
And we forgive him.
he's also left Hollywood to run a restaurant in DeKalb.
One of the reasons he's been forgiven. For someone who's helped make an incredibly bad movie, his cooking is excellent.
Giving a special shout-out to Kevin.
If you're ever in DeKalb, Illinois, we would like you to patronize a wonderful restaurant called Sorrento's.
And no, they didn't pay for advertising.
Batman Forever, Batman and Robin, and Steel were not the only bad comic book movies of that decade.
No, they were the ones that were released by DC. If you want really bad, and keep in mind that we're comparing this to Steel.
Notably absent from our list is the Brooke Shields movie Brenda Starr.
I've been trying to wipe that one from my memory as well.
But Madonna did the ever-popular Dick Tracy movie.
I'm not even going to go there.
Lori Petty was in the famous Tank Girl movie. If you're into B-movies, it could actually be quite enjoyable. I personally like Tank Girl. Don't get me wrong, it is a bad movie.
It was also the start of Naomi Watts' movie career. She plays Tank Girl's sidekick.
Sylvester Stallone started in a little movie called Judge Dredd, and these were not the worst of the movies. The worst of them were never in the movie theaters. I refer to Billy Mooney's Captain America movie and Roger Corman's Fantastic Four. These movies can be caught out there.
Probably at your local comic book convention, you can find a copy of them laying around someplace.
Warning, if, after the most recent Fantastic Four movie, Rise of the Silver Surfer, you find the incredible urge to see the Roger Corman 1994 version,
grab a 2x4 and slam yourself over the head about a dozen times, you'll get over it.
It's kind of like Oedipus. After you see it, you're going to want to poke your eyes out.
But in this decade of horrible films, there were a couple of bright, shining spots. Strangely enough, one of those bright, shining spots was actually a Wesley Snipes film about vampires.
What can you really say bad about Blade? At the time, it was an almost unknown comic book. It's a bloody, violent movie. I guess I would have to put it this way. Again, it's an incredibly good B-movie. So good, in fact, that it makes it an adequate A-movie.
The thing that this movie had going for it was that it didn't put on any pretenses. It told people what it was, a gory, violent, bordering on horror flick. But it actually had something else going for it, too. It was literally the first successful Marvel Comics movie to come out.
I think the fact that it is a successful Marvel movie is probably its saving grace. And it opened the door to other Marvel comic movies, which truly would be A-list movies.
But those don't come around until the 2000s. I still want to hit on a couple more 1990s. You also had Men in Black.
When this movie came out, I had no idea this was a comic book. I remember laughing so hard, I fell out of my seat at this movie. Men in Black 1 is an incredible movie.
And as we mentioned earlier, Mystery Men came out at this time.
And if you know that the progenitor to Mystery Men is Flaming Carrot, give yourself a pat on the back, get out of your parents' basement, get outside and see the sunlight for a while. I have to say my favorite line out of Mystery Men, because it cracks me up every single time, when Hank Azara looks at Janine Garofalo and says, "You put your father's skull in a bowling ball?" And she goes, "No, the guy at the pro shop did it."
And we cannot leave the 1990s before mentioning The Crow. Again, this would be one of those movies that should fall into the category of there should have only been one, but the original Crow, again, dark, gritty, violent, and considering the background behind the movie, it is really hard to watch Brandon Lee get filled full of holes.
It's a shame he died while filming that. I really think that it is the tragedy that made that movie as popular as it was. I think this would have been a B-movie. I do not think this would have had mega status if it hadn't been for the notoriety.
I'll admit that the reason I went to go see it was because what had happened. But it told a really good story. I felt for the character. I had no problem with this movie. This would definitely be a 3 to 3.5 pens in the pen protector movie.
I enjoyed it. I understood what it was. To me, this was simply just a B movie. I enjoy B movies. It's not the type of movie that I would ever have gone out to see a second time. It's not a movie in my DVD collection. Just simply an enjoyable one-time flick. Again, like you said, this movie had 3 sequels, and the thing that I enjoy most about the Crow series is that Crow Salvation from 2000 starred a young and upcoming actress known as Kirsten Dunst.
Even that wasn't enough to get me to see Crow Salvation. That's how bad Crow City of Angels was. As much as I enjoyed the original Crow movie, when I saw City of Angels, it was like watching Highlander 2.
There should only have been one.
And in spite of the fact that Crow Wicked Prayer, which came out in 2005, has David Boreanaz in it, I can't bring myself to watch that one either.
I saw that movie.
I'm sorry.
And the only thing that I can tell you about that movie is, I saw that movie.
You've managed to actually wipe that one from your memory, huh?
Thank goodness.
So as long as we're discussing the Crow sequels, I think that's a good way to come into the 21st century. Or
that was a really bad way to come into the 21st century. Fortunately for us, there's a lot of really good movies that would follow.
We're in the independent labels. Let's stay there for a moment. Talk about some of the ones that came out in 2000 on. You have From Hell.
If for no other reason than this starred Johnny Depp, it would be a movie to go see.
It's an interesting take on the Jack the Ripper story. It's very violent, very bloody. I do not recommend it for anyone under the age of 18. That being said, as long as you know what you're walking into, it's a halfway decent film.
Which is better than some of the other independent movies that have come out this century, such as Men in Black 2 and Son of the Mask.
You know this is not a particularly good sign for sequels of independent comics.
The good news is we found a cellmate for Joel Schumacher, and his name is Jamie Kennedy. Let's talk about something that I believe we disagree on, Sin City.
I know for a fact we disagree on this one, because I'm pretty sure that I enjoyed it a lot more than you did. I'm a humongous Robert Rodriguez fan. Pretty much if it has his name on it, I'll go out of my way to see it, even if I think it's going to be garbage, because usually he proves me wrong.
Yeah, well, at least with Sin City, he didn't.
I enjoyed the storytelling aspect of it. I enjoyed the background on how they made the film. I kept in mind the fact that they were literally reproducing panels from the comic book onto the screen. It added to the experience for me.
I will qualify my opinion of this movie. First, I completely agree with you on Robert Rodriguez. I enjoyed everything from El Mariachi to Spy Kids, and I even found Sharkboy and Lava Girl to have redeeming moments. Sin City, based on the comic book by Frank Miller. I respect Frank Miller as a comic book writer. I think Batman Year One is one of the most brilliant pieces of Batman ever written. I thoroughly enjoyed The Dark Knight Returns. His sequel to The Dark Knight Returns, I'm not really sure who wrote that, but it could not possibly have been Frank Miller.
Again, we can't rule out the possibility of 2x4s being involved.
But I thoroughly give Frank the blame for me not enjoying Sin City. Robert Rodriguez directed an absolutely beautiful movie. I think the CGI in this movie is some of the most creative I have ever seen. A brilliant cast. There is not a person in this movie who is not perfectly cast for their role. My entire complaint is I hated every single one of them. There was not a redeeming person in this movie. The story was all about bad people doing bad things.
Even the character with the most redeeming qualities ends up doing things that I am morally opposed to.
I'm not a prude. I just think this is a movie which glorifies violence. It glorifies evil. It objectifies women. This is an absolutely incredibly sorry tale. The fact that they're going to do a sequel to it because it made a bunch of money just pisses me off.
But tell us how you really feel.
For what it's worth, I wouldn't put Frank Miller or Robert Rodriguez next to Joel Schumacher. They can get out on a work release program.
So we agree to disagree on Sin City. There was a Chow Yun-fat movie called Bulletproof Monk that came out in 2003. And lastly, in this category, we have Hellboy. It has Ron Perlman in it. That was enough right there for me to go, yes, I'm going to see this movie.
It has Selma Blair in it. That's enough for me to say, I'm going to go see this movie.
And it has a character who's voiced by David Hyde Pierce. That was enough for us to go,
I'll go see it anyways.
I don't know. I still liked him as Sideshow Cecil. Hellboy did well enough that it is warranting a sequel, which has just recently begun filming.
And don't forget the two animated direct-to-video movies that star the voice talent of the movie.
Can I please forget about them?
Have you actually seen them?
Yes.
Oh.
Pretty please, can I forget about them?
I don't know. Let's hear how you feel about them.
Earlier on, we mentioned the graphic novel From Hell. DC, in the first half of the 2000s, really focused in heavily on graphic novels.
We've got Road to Perdition with Tom Hanks, The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen
with Sean Connery,
A History of Violence with Viggo Mortensen.
I'm glad you knew who was in that one.
And The Fountain with Hugh Jackman. Well, what do we say about these?
I haven't seen The Fountain yet. I didn't see Road to Perdition because it stars Tom Hanks, and I didn't see A History of Violence.
All right, I think that's a really good place to start. We didn't see them. We didn't even bother to rent them.
I just rented The Fountain.
I just rented The Fountain. Haven't seen it yet. V for Vendetta, produced by the Matrix Brothers, starring Hugo Weaving and Natalie Portman.
You just hit on the reason I saw the movie. I love Natalie Portman.
And Hugo Weaving, he's come a long way from Agent Smith. He really does have a full dramatic range. And I think as a guy who wears a mask in this entire movie, he expresses a lot of emotion just through his voice and his movements.
he did the one thing that all actors claim cannot be done. He emoted, even though you couldn't see his eyes, you couldn't see his face. All you had to work on was his voice, and it worked.
If it weren't a science fiction movie, I think he could have been nominated for Academy Award for this movie.
He should have, yes.
Again, it's a very politically charged movie, but then again, it was a very politically charged comic book. That was the point of V for Vendetta. I think what you're hearing is four pens in the pocket protector from both of us.
I'd probably go 3.5, but I'm a little bit more frugal with my pens than you are.
As we've described, the graphic novels really didn't go over very well from DC, and this continued with some of their traditional line also. For instance, Catwoman. Halle Berry does not make a real good replacement for Michelle Pfeiffer.
Or Julie Newmar. Let's take Halle Berry and put her in a skin-tight outfit. That does have certain marketing potential to it.
Yeah, but if you have no script, you might as well let Joel Schumacher direct it.
We also had Constantine, which has your man crush in it.
And given the fact that it has my man crush in it, I will definitely say it was worth watching. It is hard to defend Keanu. He is not the world's greatest actor. He is certainly no Kevin Costner either.
He can act his way out of a paper bag. It usually takes somebody going into the paper bag before him and drawing him a map on the side of it, but he can at least get out of the paper bag.
He's not the first actor who's needed cue cards.
The biggest problem that Constantine had was the fans. People had a fit because he wasn't blonde-haired, he didn't speak with a British accent, so therefore the movie's just gotta stink because it doesn't meet the fans' finickiness.
I give you that point, and it does have a second problem. It did not appeal to the people who weren't fans either.
It is a bit of a strange concept to try to wrap your brain around.
So we've hit upon the Independents. We've hit upon some of the unsuccessful and moderately successful DC comics. What's left is
The World's Finest.
We've got Batman Begins and Superman Returns. I don't know whether I was surprised or not, because they really picked a well-known comic villain, not somebody who's in the common consciousness for Batman. I mean, everybody knows who the Joker is. Everybody knows who the Penguin and Catwoman are. But in the popular American consciousness, who knows Ra's al Ghul?
Only your big old comic book geeks.
Or your big old comic book perps.
We spoke earlier about Tim Burton's Batman and how people were questioning whether it was going to be good or not. When I heard that Christopher Nolan was going to be directing Batman Returns, I knew it was going to be great.
For Batman Begins, there is a certain irony to me. Batman is an American icon. It's shot by an English director with Christian Bale, an English actor, and Michael Caine, an English actor, and Liam Neeson, an English actor. And our token American was Katie Holmes. Again, America represents all that's bad in the world.
No. Keep in mind that Batman Begins had Katie Holmes pre-brainwashing.
At least she's being replaced by Maggie Gyllenhaal, my future wife.
Does Karen know about this?
What she doesn't know won't put me in the grave.
Does Maggie know about this?
What she doesn't know will keep me out of jail. I think we will find no disagreement on the issue of Batman Begins.
That being said, Superman Returns makes a wonderful Superman 3.
Absolutely. Bryan Singer understands something that Richard Lester did not.
Now, I will say, after seeing Richard Donner's Superman 2, Superman Returns does work better as a sequel to Richard Lester's Superman 2.
However, at the time that Superman Returns was written, there was no such thing as a Richard Donner Superman 2.
Now, I know among the Three Musketeers, Ken absolutely adored Superman Returns. I thoroughly enjoyed Superman Returns. Even bordering on having a movie crush. Of the three of us, you were on the lower end of the scale, but out of four pens in the pocket protector, you still give it a...
Three and a half pens. For those who don't know the Third Musketeer, his name is Ken Halloran, and is the producer of TWRPS in charge of obscure literary references. Honestly, there's only two minor issues I have with this movie. The first issue I have is Superman 1 and Superman 2 were action movies. Superman Returns was a drama. It had some action in it. But overall, it was a drama. The second problem that I really had with this movie was the ending was really drawn out. For me, the movie was effectively over when Superman threw the Krypton continent into outer space. However, the movie had almost another half an hour after that.
I didn't have a problem with it not being action-heavy. To be honest with you, most people who cap on it because it's not an action movie, I tisk-tisk, because it has great storytelling to it. We hit on this last time. Pirates of the Caribbean, great action movie. As far as having a story to it, not so much.
Well, Superman the comic really could not have survived 50-plus years without having some really good storytelling. And let's face it, Superman's arch-nemesis is Lex Luthor. He is an ordinary human being. If every episode had to be a fight between Superman and Lex Luthor and have some sort of action in it, it would be over really quick. Superman, in at least one episode, would accidentally break Lex Luthor's neck, and that would be the end of that rivalry.
Which is exactly my point. Unfortunately, in this day and age, people want throwdowns. And it's that type of mentality that led to the creation of characters like Doomsday.
Who is nothing more than a character built specifically to beat Superman.
That being said, people who say, oh, there wasn't enough action, or that there should have been somebody that Superman could have gone toe-to-toe with, that's not necessarily good storytelling. In this day and age, Hollywood needs to make sure that people know what they're going to see. Those people who went to go see Superman Returns, expecting to see a super rumble, were sorely disappointed. Those people who were going to see a well-told story were not, or at least not majorly disappointed. To be completely honest, though, the 21st century really has been dominated by Marvel. I hate to say that. I've been part of the DC Nation for over 2 decades. Superman was the first one out of the gate, but as far as modern-day 21st century films go, Marvel has dominated the field.
Honestly, it's been a refreshing turnaround. I started my comic book reading days as a Marvel zombie. Spider-Man was one of the forces that really turned around that luck for Marvel.
Between Sam Raimi and Bryan Singer, they put Marvel on the map as far as movies are concerned.
And who would have expected of Sam Raimi? Here's a guy who directed Evil Dead and Darkman. I almost laughed thinking that Sam Raimi was going to make a Spider-Man movie. Among the reasons that I underestimated Sam Raimi, I did not realize what a Spider-Man fan he was. He wanted to make a movie that was true to Spider-Man. He did a marvelous job. Sam Raimi has given us 3 very wonderful Spider-Man movies, and the fan in me wants to see 3 more of these movies made by Sam Raimi.
So you've got the X-Men movies, the Spider-Man movies. Blade even had a couple of sequels in there. All of these were very profitable and very good.
Now, Marvel has not been all successes in the 21st century. I think that I enjoyed the Hulk movie more than just about anybody else I know. It's not a horrible movie.
No. It's not horrible by any stretch of the imagination. It's just not as good as everybody was expecting. And I think that's the biggest drawback it had. Everybody was expecting so much more of this film. It was kind of like Phantom Menace. Everybody was expecting a miracle, and it didn't live up to the hype. So Hulk didn't go over that well. Punisher, it's really hard for me to get behind a Punisher film. Because, in my mind, the Punisher is not a superhero. The Punisher is not even really one of those anti-heroes. He's not in that gray area.
However, Punisher was not the only so-so movie of the 21st century for Marvel. We also have Daredevil. I think I'm the last person in America who actually enjoys Ben Affleck movies.
Yeah, there is electroshock therapy for that.
Electro, what more do you need? It's got Jennifer Garner in it. Oh yeah, a script.
Decent direction.
It's got Jennifer Garner in it. Go see it.
If you enjoy Jennifer Garner in skin-tight leather, then go see it. I think that's what he just said. So, you got Daredevil, you got Hulk, you've got Punisher, you've got Elektra.
And the movie that totally surprises me, that got a sequel, The Fantastic Four.
Why did that surprise you?
Whereas it made some money, I was not under the impression that it was an incredible blockbuster for the studio.
Well, the one thing that I will point out is that the first Fantastic Four movie was put out within a month of Batman Begins. That being said, I believe that kind of skews a person's outlook.
When I saw the previews for Fantastic Four, I thought, here's a movie that's going to be so incredibly sucky that the only thing it'll be better than is the Roger Corman Fantastic Four movie. I was pleasantly surprised to find out it did not suck.
Well, I knew it wasn't going to be as bad as either one of the Punisher films.
It's actually a halfway decent movie. It's no blockbuster, it's no Christopher Reeve Superman movie, but it's actually a fun little flick. And it's got Jessica Alba in it.
When I saw the advertising for the first Fantastic Four movie, I knew that it was going to do better than, say, Daredevil or The Hulk, just because it didn't skew so far from the source material. Now, yes, there are people out there who are going to say, oh, it skewed so badly. Well, you people are way too finicky for your own good. It did a good job of bringing the Fantastic Four's origin story into the 21st century.
Perhaps not as good as Spider-Man did. We updated Spider-Man to be a genetically altered spider.
It's funny because the same people who griped and complained about the space station for the Fantastic Four are usually the exact same people who griped and complained about the genetically mutated spider and the organic spider webs and the Green Goblin armor.
And I know Sam Raimi wants to take credit for the organic spider webs, but that really belongs to Peter David in Spider-Man 2099.
I remember that comic book. But then again, we've already established how big a twerps we are.
So what really amounts to relatively minor changes in the origin. I mean, it's still the cosmic radiation. They have the exact same powers for nearly the exact same reason. I mean, it's not a bad retelling of the story.
The only major difference is the fact that now Victor Von Doom is on the space station with them and he gets powers too. Actually, it's not the Fantastic Four that get changed at all. It's Victor Von Doom.
It's a major change. However, in the time constraint that you have in a comic movie, you have this 2 to 2.5 hour range where you have to tell the entire story. If you were going to tell the entire origin of Victor Von Doom and the entire origin of the Fantastic Four, you really don't have time for the rest of the movie.
Oh, wait. This movie was called Fantastic Four, not Victor Von Doom.
I'll give you that's a major change, but I think in terms of storytelling, it actually tightens the story a lot more to say that he was created in the same incident that creates Fantastic Four. And I think this is a perfect segue to talk about the changes in Fantastic Four Rise of the Silver Surfer. If you have seen this movie, you know exactly what I'm talking about, and if you haven't, this is the spoiler time. You want to fast forward or pause at this point. Alright, that break was enough. Let's talk Galactus.
To me, Galactus, the cosmic entity that he is portrayed as in Fantastic Four, Rise of the Silver Surfer, is excellent.
I think, although the script never comes out and says it, visually, what I received from the story was that Galactus was a natural space phenomenon. It was a living creature, and what it happened to feed on is planets.
It had a sentience about it. It was motivated. It was directed. That being said, it doesn't have to look human.
Definitely. It was not humanized.
And in a lot of ways, that made it a lot easier to believe that it would destroy these planets without a moment's hesitation. There was nothing human about this creature.
Which kind of brings into a minor issue for me, is if Galactus has chosen Norrin Radd to be the Silver Surfer, why was the Silver Surfer in a biped humanoid form, and why the surfboard? Yes, I know the real reason is because that was the character from the comic book. But Silver Surfer could just as easily have been an amorphous metallic blob.
In a lot of ways, though, in this movie, he is an amorphous metal blob. Yes, he was once a humanoid creature, but there is a scene where you just see the surfboard flying along, and he rises up out of the surfboard. So there is an amorphous-type quality to him.
The movie does show the Silver Surfer leaving another planet. I think if you had seen him on that planet, and he looks like the creatures of that planet, or the surfboard actually looks more like a mode of transport indicative to that planet, that it would make more sense on Earth he would look human or ride a surfboard.
But again, let's go back to what we said about the first Fantastic Four movie, about pacing and wanting to keep things moving and not confusing the audience.
I don't think that my problem with it in any way takes away from the story or the plot or the enjoyment of this movie. I think it's just a minor issue. How come Galactus looks like a natural space phenomenon, but the Silver Surfer looks like a guy from Hawaii with a silver tan? Another issue that I had with this movie, again, it's not a major story plot or not a major issue, but I think it was a poor choice on the part of the producers. I understand that in the comic book, Susie Storm is a blonde Caucasian woman. Equally, I understand that Jessica Alba is a Latina. I don't understand why the producers make her up so heavily to try and make Jessica Alba look like a blonde Caucasian woman. I was highly offended by that.
It does kind of seem like a contradiction because of the fact that they put so much effort into making sure that Sue Storm looked just like she did in the comics. And then to go and make Galactus look so different. Why couldn't they have met halfway with Jessica Alba? I understand you can't have a brown-haired Sue Storm. People would lose their ever-loving internet minds.
Any more so than Galactus being an amorphous space blob?
Oh, they're losing their minds over that one, too. But it's not like she has a deep skin tone. They could have left it natural. I've seen pictures of Jessica Alba with the blonde hair and her natural skin tone. It just looks like Sue Storm has been out in the sun a little bit. it didn't need as much attention given to it as they obviously did.
Frankly, I think it's a slap in the face. I think that of any issue I've had with the movies we've discussed today, it's the one that I find the most disgusting. And there's no reason to assume that because you have a major lead actress that automatically she's got to be white. I'm surprised, honestly, that people aren't protesting this movie, just for this very reason. Note to the producers, those contacts look like crap. You should have just digitally changed your eye color if you wanted her to have blue eyes.
I think if they were going to make a protest, they would have needed to do it in the first movie, because they did do it in the first movie as well. So trying to object to it at this point in the game might be a little bit late. That's not negating anything that you said, it's just a point of fact. Not to negate your point in any way, shape, or form, but that did not distract me from enjoying this movie. The only time it really drew my attention in any way, shape, or form was when they did the gratuitous, almost naked scene.
And it was gratuitous. It really was. It was unnecessary to the story. It was funny, but it was a cheap laugh.
It was funny, but at the same time, I found it amazing that all of their clothes, everything that they wore in this movie, was made out of unstable molecules, except for that one outfit.
Yeah, Johnny conveniently had on his unstable molecule clothes underneath everything he wore.
Including his tuxedo.
Reed's tuxedo. It could stretch.
Reed's tuxedo, Reed's street clothes. In fact, when you saw her turn invisible in those clothes, the clothes disappeared with her. And according to what was established, if she turned invisible without the unstable molecules, her clothes remained visible.
Truly, in this time, she could make other things turn invisible.
Don't get me wrong, it was nice to see that they had gained a lot more control over their powers. The point is that she didn't need to be laying there buck naked, except for a set of legs that were covering up the important parts, in order to keep it PG-13. Never in a million years did I ever think I would object to the idea of Jessica Alba being naked.
I'm not saying that I object to it. I'm just saying it was gratuitous.
There's a difference there.
Exactly.
So, overall, because we really did build this as our Fantastic Four episode, so we really should give just a little bit of extra effort to this one. Overall high point of the movie?
Ironically, I think my overall high point in the movie is maybe not even the strongest part of the movie. There's a moment of conflict that just was intense for me. And it's when the Fantastic Four first sees Victor Von Doom apparently coming back from the dead. And they're about ready to trash him. And they have to be held back because, as Von Doom normally does when he comes to America, he has some sort of immunity, and they're told to back off. And they say that conflict is the art of telling these type of stories. I thought the conflict in that scene was just great.
For me, it was the moment of the reveal. The moment that we realize that the Silver Surfer isn't the big bad guy that everybody believes that he is. The moment he illustrates his quote-unquote humanity.
Almost the same point, as it is a point of conflict in the story. Up to this point in the movie, every character thinks the Silver Surfer is the big bad guy. And now all of a sudden, through the Fantastic Four, we see he's not the bad guy. He's just been placed in a terrible position.
He truly is in a no-win situation. Now, flip side of the coin. Negative point.
As far as story and plot go, the only thing that I would find to be a real big negative was the commercialism. Just showing that the Fantastic Four gets all of their money from publicity. From selling exclusive photographs to the wedding, from selling space on their costumes for advertising like they're a NASCAR. It would have been more to me to say Reed Richards has a lot of patents and that's why they're rich than saying, yes, they are the ultimate capitalists.
I didn't take it so much as the Fantastic Four were the ultimate capitalists as much as Johnny Storm wanted to be the ultimate capitalist.
But Reed and Sue never said no.
For me, again, I'm going to put out the warning. I'm about to give a major spoiler. If you have not seen the movie, pause now, go on out, see the movie, then come back and hit the play button again. Okay? Okay.
Well, welcome back. How'd you enjoy the movie?
For me, the fact that the climax of the film turns this movie into a Silver Surfer movie and not a Fantastic Four movie was a little bit of a detriment. Yes, I realize this was Fantastic Four, Rise of the Silver Surfer. I felt as though the Fantastic Four should have had more of an impact on dispatching the big menace than they did.
What they were saying to me was that the only person who had the power to stop this was the Silver Surfer. And for many planets before Earth, Silver Surfer did not choose to stop. He could have at any point stopped Galactus. But it was the Fantastic Four. It was the teamwork. It was the love that Reed and Sue had. It was the love that Sue was able to bring out in the Silver Surfer that allowed him to break his programming or whatever he has with Galactus and to fight back.
Maybe I'm guilty of the exact thing that I've been griping about in regards to comic book fans. But in the source material, Reed Richards contributed to Galactus being dispatched from Earth. Yes, they take care of Victor Von Doom. But in the end, when it comes to dealing with this great big global threat, the fact that they are relegated to sitting back and watching, or in Johnny's case, giving the guy a push, just seemed almost anticlimactic to me.
In the source material, Silver Surfer did not have the power to dispatch Galactus alone.
It doesn't seem very logical to me to give your quote-unquote herald enough power to turn around and completely destroy you. That doesn't seem very believable to me. So, overall, out of a total of 4 pens in the pocket protector, how many pens do you give it?
Honestly, I would only give it 2.5 pens. That's not a put-down. It was a fine movie, and it will be added to my DVD collection as soon as it is available. That being said, it is no Batman Begins.
I as well will give it 2.5. We didn't really hit on Ghost Rider, but that's okay, because it kind of falls in that same category as the first Blade movie, the first Fantastic Four movie. It was good for what it was, but it wasn't phenomenal.
At this point, I guess I would like to wrap up with just some thoughts on movies that are in production to come out in the near future.
For DC, we have a movie called Stardust coming out in 2007. I believe it's another graphic novel movie. You've got The Dark Knight in 2008, along with The Watchmen in 2008.
Which, for those of us who read The Watchmen, we've been waiting for nearly 20 years now.
And then, of course, we have Superman, The Man of Steel, in 2009. On Marvel's slate in 2008, they have both Iron Man and The Incredible Hulk, which is not necessarily a sequel to Ang Lee's Hulk.
Speaking of Incredible Hulk, this is penned by Zach Penn, who has been tapped to write the Avengers movie. Just to mention a couple other Marvel movies, Captain America is being written by David Self, and Submariner has Jonathan Mostow attached to it, who you may remember as the director of Terminator 3.
I remember 5 years ago when Kevin Smith was on deck to write a Submariner film.
Which was going to be right after his Green Hornet movie, wasn't it?
That's the problem with taking some of this hype too much for granted, is that most of this stuff probably will never reach production. It will hit the pre-production stage and just die. But before we get onto that, there are 2 more release dates that started production. Once they enter into production, it's a pretty safe bet that it will hit the theaters. And those are 2 independents, the Hellboy sequel, The Golden Army, and Sin City 2, which I know Doug's just looking so forward to seeing. Now, we're going to rattle off a list.
Constantine 2.
Dead Man.
Death and Me.
Doom Patrol.
The Flash.
Green Lantern.
The Justice League.
Losers.
Metal Men.
Metamorpho.
Shazam.
The Spirit.
Supermax, the Green Arrow in prison movie.
Teen Titans.
We 3.
Wonder Woman.
Why, The Last Man.
Ant-Man.
Avengers.
Black Panther.
Captain America.
Cloak and Dagger.
Deathlok.
Doctor Strange.
Gargoyle.
Ghost Rider 2.
Hands of Shang-Chi.
Hawkeye.
Iron Fist.
Luke Cage.
Magneto.
Nick Fury.
Power Pack.
Punisher 2.
Silver Surfer.
Spider-Man 4.
Submariner.
Thor.
Werewolf by Night.
Wolverine.
X-Men 4.
Spawn 2.
The Ghost Who Walks, also known as the Phantom.
And Mandrake the Magician. Now, of those 44 movies that we just rattled off, probably only about 20% of them will...
If we see 4 of them, I'll be happy. Well, depending on which 4.
Now, Ant-Man, written by Edgar Wright, who is behind Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz. While I enjoyed Hot Fuzz and was pleasantly surprised by Shaun of the Dead, the idea of him tackling one of my favorite Marvel characters is kind of scary. But that being said, if you go back and re-listen to that list, and we rattled through them pretty quickly, you will notice that there are a lot of B and C level characters on those lists. We talked about B and C level characters when we talked about Swamp Thing. they are running the risk of flooding the market if they were actually to do all 44 of these movies.
Oh, I'd say that's no risk. That's a sure thing. And frankly, I'd rather see Swamp Thing Part 3 than the Power Pack movie.
There were 5 superhero movies released this year. On an average, that means that one came out about every 2 months. That's already running the risk of flooding the market. We do want to give a little plug to upcoming Twerp Productions. Just as a reminder, we do produce the Star Trek Eras audio drama. We just released Act 2 of our second episode, To Err Is Human, this past Saturday on June 16th, and Act 3 will be out by July 12th. We've also started recording Episode 3 of Star Trek Eras, which is entitled Yours, Mines, and Ours, and we will begin casting our third Twerps production, I'm One 4, in July.
Which, for those of you listening today, this is going to be our superhero show.
Which means that if you're really interested in superheroes, and you're interested in getting in on the ground floor of audio productions, this is your time to do it. We have just posted on our website a Help Wanted area. Just look for Uncle Sam, read through the instructions, and send us an email letting us know that you would like to be a Twerp.
We would like to thank you for listening to HeroCast, Twerpcast Episode 2. And we encourage you to provide any and all forms of creative feedback to jim@twerponline.net.
Thank you again for joining us on this extended version of Twerpcast. Twerpcast is a production of Timewell Electronic Recording Productions, copyright 2007.
Look, up in the sky!